Okay, welcome. Welcome, everyone.
To our lunch talk. Just a reminder before I introduce Neva to everyone that this is going to be recorded and not streamed, right? Just recorded and put streamed as well. So try to be thoughtful in your comments if you don't want to be embarrassed in front of the entire world. We're extremely lucky to have Neva Elkin-Koren speak to us and spend, spend the first academic period after stepping down from being Dean of Haifa Law School. Congratulations on joining the ranks of those of us who just sort of hang around thinking and writing as opposed to actually managing lots of people and fighting crazy right-wingers who hate you because you actually care about diversity and all sorts of things like that. But let's put that to the side. To those of you who don't know Neva Elkin-Koren, she's been around and at the core of the debates over copyright and the net since just a little bit before HTML got introduced. She was the first person who wrote in a sustained way about the relationship between democratic theory and the distribution of meaning-making and copyright online. She was the first person that I at least heard from, who began to really understand the dangers of a very powerful Google when Google was still sort of the most exciting do-no-evil. Certainly the first person I saw in the Invisible Handshake paper who looked at the dangers of the collaboration between the state and private companies to create new avenues for suppression and surveillance, and wrote the first significant critique of Creative Commons from a commons perspective as opposed to from a property perspective, and has systematically been somewhere between 5 and 15 years ahead of the field on many, many things. And it's just a real delight to have you come and talk to us today about what you're interested in.
Oops. Thank you. It's great to be here. It's a great pleasure to spend this first day of freedom here. And I'll try also to be thoughtful as we got this warning about streaming. And I'd like to talk today about something that is somewhat unrelated to the theoretical questions that Yochai was mentioning, but more connected to law in action and to legal practice. And I think one of the most interesting challenges or important challenges in the copyright era is to design strategies for facilitating access to knowledge and to push against the expansion of copyright. The question of what is the best way to do that within the legal arena is, I think, becoming a more important question than it has been in the past. And I'd like to look at this question, at the legal strategy of facilitating access to knowledge within copyright law from the perspective of fair use best practices. And I think that gaining a better understanding of best practices, the legal status, how they work, and how they interface with the legal regime will also give us some insights related to the broader question that is the interface between legal activism, social activism, and political activism, and some of the legal frameworks that we are using. So the question is basically how to facilitate access to knowledge using copyright law. And of course, we know copyright law is doing this using two different strategies. One is the It's rule-based, that is more common in continental Europe, using exceptions and limitations that are strictly defined. And the other is principle-based, that is using principles, considerations that are considered by the courts retrospectively to determine whether a use was fair or not. So this is regardless of what we consider as appropriate use. It should be facilitated as unlicensed use, or what should be the scope of such exempted use. These are the two main legal strategies that we are using in the United States. The fair use, for instance, would require us to go through the fair use analysis, working through these four considerations, considering the purpose and characters of the use, the nature of the copyrighted work, the amount taken from the copyrighted work, and also the potential market harm. Now, when we use this type of strategy, we, of course, trade some of the certainties that is provided by exceptions and limitations that are strictly defined for the flexibility that is provided by fair use. And flexibility becomes something that is really important, especially as we want to adjust our legal tools to face some of the challenges created by technology. If we want to have to make sure that our system of copyright enable us to make the uses that we used to make in the pre-digital age, we need to have some flexibility. And if you simply look at the fair use cases of the past couple of years, without fair use, it would have been very difficult to adjust our system to, to apply to digital sampling for review, to apply for a digital display of images if you're a search engine, for creating remote digital copying, some of the cases that were litigated in the United States. And another way to appreciate flexibility is also to look at what is happening in Europe, where you see many countries struggling with the fact that they cannot adjust their copyright law. At the same time, however, for this flexibility, we pay a price with inserting a high level of uncertainty into the system that is causing the well-known chilling effect. So when users do not know what the rule is, they would underuse creative works, fearing the risk of legal liability. That is especially true for the context that I'd like to discuss today, that is educational use. Teachers, educational institutions would rather avoid a use, even if it is legitimate, just because they don't want to risk the a potential legal liability. Why would I care about giving materials to students using a new system if that would potentially put me personally and my institution at risk? A more interesting point is that uncertainty is linked to power. And when we look at rules that create uncertainty, such as fair use, that are complex, that are difficult to understand, that require comprehensive legal advice, that these rules would have a bias toward more powerful players, just simply because they're able to take advantage of this type of system. So for Google, it would be easier to challenge fair use in court in the Google Book Search project, whereas you think of small startups, individual users, for which this type of challenge would be expensive and in most cases would be a risk that they will not be able to afford. And for that reason, we usually think of this type of uncertainty created by fair use as something that is facilitating a culture of clearance, where most players, in this context, and that is true especially for educational institutions, would rather purchase a license, would get a blanket license to use whatever you need to switch. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So my new startup is to develop some devices that would fit a dress. All right, so now you can hear me. That's better? Okay. So a clearance culture, a culture where every license, every use requires a license, is something that would be promoted by the uncertainty in fair use. So what I'd like to do today in this talk, and to do it very briefly, because I really, the purpose of giving this talk to this forum was not just to present some of our experiences and to share with you some of the insights based on a case study that we had in Israel, but also to get your input on some of the issues. So I'd really like to briefly go through some of the issues listed on this site, on this slide. But what I want to do is to examine this flexibility and flexibility versus uncertainty debate within the context of educational use. The reason for doing or for looking at educational fair use is, well, there are two reasons. One is that there are a few cases that all of a sudden were held by courts around the world that, you know, after a long period of time where we heard nothing from the court related to educational fair use. But also because educational fair use is actually at the core of copyright. There is consensus related to the importance of educational fair use. Most players, even the most conservative scholars and judges within that are working on copyright would agree that educational use should be promoted. And then the question here is really how to do that. What is the best way to do that? And that, therefore, it creates a distinct challenge. So I'll talk a little bit about educational fair use, and I'll look at the way in which fair use could be supplemented by best code of best practices, drawing, you know, sharing with you some insights based on our Israeli case study. And then where I really would like to think aloud and also get some input from you is how we can take best practices to the next stage and move it from the social norm practices and community building and social activism into the legal arena. So what are the challenges for educational fair use? When we look at education in the new environment, the digital environment, there are lots of opportunities for using copyrighted materials, but at the same time, we see a decrease of transaction costs, which leads to the proliferation of a lot of licenses. We see the emergence of many licensing schemes where in the past you would have purchased a book or a journal and you could turn it into a resource that could be used by students. Now you can, you're more and more pushed into a regime where you actually have to license an article that creates a huge cost in some, for educational institutions in terms of the licensing practices. So reduce transaction costs from the perspective of the publishers of just offering a license for educational use, increase the cost at the side of educational institutions, also the cost itself. You know, if you can look at this, you know, some of these of this data was published published, I think, at the time where there was an academic rebel against Elsevier. But you can see that the actual cost of access are increasing. The fees become expensive, and it's not only related to articles, but the more it becomes easier to license and to monitor the use, you can make available a lot of content that is metered. So, if we were experiencing in the past decade an environment where we can get a lot of materials for free. I have a lot of friends that are teaching music, and they were using materials on YouTube. As we go along, that's most of these materials become subject to some sort of monitoring, but also some sort of licensing scheme, a metered use, and automated detection. More and more, we see a lot of use or an increased use of this content ID infrastructure by YouTube. Even the shift from book in print to book in a digital format, it's neat, it's cool, it enables us to do a lot of things. For instance, to read and enlarge the letters, to insert your comments, to see what other people have highlighted, and share the reading with others. But of course, reading a book using an e-reader would also enable distributors to restrict some of the use and to make some of the use contingent upon additional license, like reading aloud, listening to a book, reading only excerpts of the book. There are lots of business models that could be implemented using this type of device that would make it very different from the type of experience that we had when we were using books that are the main instrument for consuming knowledge in an educational setting. Of course, the most extreme example is the 1984 saga, where Amazon was deleting that book from the Kindle devices that already downloaded it in 2009. E-books can be read on e-readers, but e-books, as the Wall Street Journal reported last month, and nicely put it, you can read the e-book, but the e-book can also read you, therefore changing, you know, some of the experiences that we sort of consider intimate while reading. Especially that is important for the educational context, where we want to sometimes protect this type of intimacy between teachers and their students, not just in elementary school, but also in college and university settings. So what is it that we need for educational fair use? If we think of our wish list in this type of environment, we want to make sure that choices related to the reading materials are not linked to cost. We want to avoid the situation where teachers and college professors and professors at university would decide to assign materials mainly based on what licenses are available and or how much it costs. I must say that even as a law professor, I increasingly face this dilemma. You know, I increasingly choose materials for my students that would be free or would cost less, hopefully not compromising the type of teaching offerings that that become available to them in the learning materials, but I think that's a critical issue from a social welfare perspective. We want to make sure that access to learning materials is not dependent on cost, right? And so that students can afford it, that it does not become a barrier, not in terms of the license, but also in terms of the cost that it, that students eventually have to bear. We want to make sure that teachers and professors can make spontaneous use. They don't have to license the materials that they want to use in class months in advance and clear the rights, and only those materials that were cleared way in advance would become available so that professors and teachers could respond to timely needs of the teaching experience. We want to make sure that students and teachers can also freely use materials, not just in terms of access, but just in terms of what they can do with it. How can they learn from it? Whether they can transform it, incorporate it into their own work, change it, explore how it works. We want to protect what I was referring to before, that is the intimacy, or sometimes the secrecy, even of a protected academic setting where you want to have students able to explore the learning experience without fearing that someone is monitoring them. And so if this sounds a bit paranoid, you know, if you look at the Georgia State University case that I will talk about in a minute, one of the requests of the publishers that were the plaintiffs in that case was to provide access to the reading habits of students and to be able to monitor it in real time. So we want to be able to avoid that. And I think the last point I'd like to make, and I think that that should be buried in mind, is that we really want to keep professors and teachers in the educational context. We don't want them to simply opt out and leave their students on their own to look for materials and to access materials. We want teachers to be able to select materials, to edit materials, to put it on a university setting. If you have a copyright regime that is really pushing administrators, teachers, professors to the corner, the only rational thing to say is, here is the list, give it to your students, and let them find it. It's not going to promote compliance with copyright, let me tell you. In most cases, what you'll see is a lot more piracy. But I think that we are also at the same time losing in terms of the input that teachers and professors could be given to their students. So this is our wish list, and let's see what the law provides us with. So the law during the 90s was providing us with very little because we had some, we had very few, decisions during the 90s. Most of them held that were related to course pack materials, where the court was saying all these course packs produced by the copy stores and commercial copiers are not fair use. And we mainly had a high level of uncertainty because none of the digital users were actually tested in court. So in this respect, the Georgia State University case is actually good news. So this case actually involved a lawsuit that was brought against Georgia State University by a couple of university press. I think it's Cambridge University Press, Oxford University Press, Sage, and the Copyright Clearance Center. And this lawsuit was brought for massive use of image mirrored reproduction, on the e-reserve system of Georgia State University, which is a system that is used by most universities. It's not, so it could be the Blackboard or the HiLearn or whatever system is being used. And the case was actually, it's a 350 pages decision related to 99 claims of particular excerpts that were taken from books, where the court is actually setting the policy that has to apply to this type of copying, but also analyzing each and every case of out of these 99 cases, finding that only 5 cases out of the 99 were actually copyright infringement and are not entitled to fair use. So what the court was doing is actually examining the copyright policies that was adopted by Georgia State University, coming to the conclusion that I would actually describe as good news. So the good news is that the court is saying that decidedly small excerpts from scholarly work, that is important, that is nonfiction, could be fair use if they meet all of these requirements that are done by nonprofit educational institution, they're done for nonprofit educational use. They are narrowly tailored to fill a legitimate purpose of teaching that is based on a declaration of each of the professors that this is actually required for teaching the course. The university has to use measures to prevent unwarranted distribution, such as making sure that only students that are enrolled have access and only for the duration of the course, and that they are being warned that they should comply with copyright and not to distribute it to strangers. The good news is that the court is holding that there is no caps in terms of the number of pages that you can copy, but provide some guideline that 10% or one chapter from a book would be reasonable. So far for the good news, but there are some bad news. And the bad news are that the court assumed that anytime a license is available, the fact that there is a license will deter, you know, against fair use, so therefore communicating a message to publishers and to copyright clearance center to create more innovative licenses for each and every use. Once a license is available and reasonably priced and is provided in a convenient format. And of course, we know that you can click easily on your iPad, on your computer screens, on your smartphones. Then no fair use. This is that's something that could really create a challenge for open access to materials, at least assuming that some unlicensed use should be permitted, not just in terms of copyright, but also in terms of freedom. Another bad news is that the court find it difficult to predict that, you know, what would be the potential market harm, and therefore sort of instruct the university and the professors to take into account that there is always a market harm. And that, of course, would create a chilling effect when each of the professors and then the university will have to decide whether items listed on the reading list constitute fair use. The main problem is with the certainty. The court refused to hold, what would be, to give some guidelines on what would be a permissible fair use, and actually rightly insist on the fact that fair use, according to the law, requires an analysis of each of the four factors in each of these cases. The 350 pages of the court could actually serve as, of the decisions could actually serve as a manual for that is covering the cases that were litigated. Doesn't cover all of the cases that any of the librarians or university administrators will have to take care of when they go through the list. It's very complicated to go through the four-factor analysis for each and every item. Now, Georgia State University was trying to come up with a solution to that by providing a copyright policy. But the court, nevertheless, even though it acknowledged the fact that there was some good intentions in adopting a policy rather than simply leaving it to the to the circumstances and to have an informed policy related to the use of copyrighted materials, nevertheless, the court found the university liable for using this copyright policy, even though it only had a very low rate of error, right? So the risk of error is on the university. The university, on its part, is actually rolling that responsibility to professors that would go through the checklist of copyright and a fair use four factors and would determine for themselves whether any of the items included in their syllabus constitute fair use. You can see that that is not a way of promoting the fair use for educational purposes. This is better, maybe better than the situation we had prior to this case, because the cases of the 90s were not even acknowledging any significance in educational fair use, but that is not that does not provide sufficient room for educational fair use. In Canada this summer we had five Supreme Court cases that were looking into fair dealing, which is actually much nearer than fair use, because it requires it would actually legitimate the use for only particular purposes. And here the court was actually moving forward with educational fair use, opening the door for treating teaching as part of private study that is a purpose that is considered legitimate under the fair dealing Canadian law. But more importantly, and I think that is the significance of the Canadian case in this case and the other five cases, is that Supreme Court of Canada, for the second time actually, but now it's really firm, is treating fair dealing as a user right, looking at users as equal participants in promoting the goal of copyright law. That is something that is really important when we think about the growing regime of licenses and DRMs that I was trying to describe before, where some of these DRMs and licenses would overwrite even fair use privileges under the law. To move quickly into fair use best practices, there are many ways in which fair use best practices could actually insert some certainty into that legal regime that of fair use that is characterized by a high level of uncertainty. And the way to do it is by empowering communities to decide for themselves what should be the scope of fair use within the context in which they operate. So the idea is that fair use best practices would be undertaken by a community, deliberating on fair use, identifying the needs for users in a particular community, and drafting a code that they can comply with. It has some obvious advantages, like identifying, the significant users, empowering users, giving them a voice, but also educating them by increasing the awareness of the fair use analysis, also encouraging users to take action and assert their rights. And so that if you're a professor that have to assign the reading materials, after you go through a process like this, you wouldn't say, okay, just give me a break, I'm going to pay the license, or I'm going to quit and let my students simply find the materials on their own, but you start to assert the rights that you think are part of users' rights in the academic setting. Taking action in this is not just by creating a community in which these practices could be implemented, but also in actually changing the fair use picture. The reason is that when we were looking at the way, or when we look at the way publishers or would actually implement their right, they would offer a license, and the more licenses are offered, the more it is assumed that without a license you cannot actually practice a particular use. If a community of users refuse to take a license and assert a user's right or a privilege or assert the rights under fair use, the actual practice that is collaborative and is common for all the members of that community could actually change the expectations for royalties and the result of the court's analysis related to the potential market harm. Because if no one is buying a license, there is no market harm, and therefore the likelihood of finding a fair use is higher. Quickly go through our experience in the Israeli setting. Israel is actually interesting in this context just because it's a very small country that can offer an experience of a little lab. So when we were forming a coalition of higher education institutions, and were able actually to enroll all or almost all of the higher education institutions in Israel just because it's such a small group. So we had the 7 major universities and most of the colleges, private and public, representing themselves or by proxy. We had a very formal institutional structure. We asked each of the presidents of these institutions to appoint a person so they will report back to them. We wanted to involve the institutions in the process. Those who were appointed by each of the presidents of the universities and colleges was either a librarian or a lawyer. Also, this combination of lawyers and librarians is important because lawyers in the institutional structure play the role of barrier, right? You come up with great ideas on how to move forward with fair use, and then you go to the legal department and they say, you can't do that. And so it was important to involve all of these players from day one. This group met for about 18 months, drafted a code of best practices, and later on reported to the institutions themselves, requiring the institutions to implement this code of best practices and thereby changing the practices and hopefully affecting the way in which the law would be implemented in these cases. We are waiting for a decision of the court. This was actually submitted to a court in Israel in a lawsuit that was brought against Hebrew University. That is actually exactly the same lawsuit that was brought against Georgia State University. And this litigation is still going on. It would be interesting to see what the court was thinking about this. Hopefully, by the time the court would make a decision, there'll be already practices on the ground that could affect the decision. But this is another, and probably one of the last points that I'd like to make. Related to the role of fair use best practices. And here is the problem. On the one hand, when you draft fair use best practices, you gather the users, right? And they decide of what should be permissible use. And the sky's the limit, right? I mean, you can identify any use that you want to make and draft it into your code. When you run this type of exercise, you want to make sure that you don't expose the members of the group to legal liability, right? So all this exercise should only be within what is conceived to be the framework that was developed by courts for fair use. So the standard cannot be too high. You also want to avoid a lower standard, right? I mean, if you simply comply with the law standard, then you create a ceiling unnecessarily impeding or creating new barriers in the way in which the institutions that are partner institutions that are involved can actually implement their fair use right. So in our own fair use best practices, the dilemma was how you can insert more certainty and at the same time keep the flexibility. The court in the Georgia State case keeps saying repeatedly that they don't want to create any ceilings, they don't want to create any caps, but they were still saying that it would be hard to see how a use could be fair if you use more than 10% to one chapter. And so simply declaring that it's something that you, a standard of use that you use, that you implement, is not a cap, is insufficient because the librarians that would have to upload or the professors that would have to click the button and say, this is part of my reading materials, would look for something simple. They cannot go through the four factors analysis. And so what we tried to do was to design a two-tier procedure that would enable both maintaining the flexibility but also inserting some certainty. And the way we did it is by designing the rules so they would be very simple and easy to implement at the copy machine, right, or at the scanning port. So you have the clear-cut rules, and then for anything that goes beyond the clear-cut rules, we established a forum that would be in each of the institutions that would be able to deliberate on that. So this institutional structure should be able to keep both the rules that could be relied on and then the new type of uses, not just in terms of amount, but also in terms of the way you want to use the material that would enable exploration, right, or testing new type of uses that go beyond the clear-cut rules that we were able to agree on in a certain point of time. So if we want to take fair use practices to the next level, question is, what are venues? How do we explore this? How do we do that? How can we turn these best practices that are increasingly adopted by communities of documentary filmmakers, of musicians, of educational institutions. How do we turn it into something that is legally significant? I already described how the actual practice, if it is practiced by the majority of users in a particular community, could actually change the law. But there are other venues that also should be explored. One is trying to use these best practices as a draft for legal reform, because once we identify the needs of a particular community, maybe we should push this either to the courts, but also to legislators. Another way to think about it is to try and develop some legal arguments that would turn this, the actual practice of using these best practices or adapting, complying with best practices as a basis for, as a type of safe harbor or an exemption from damages liability. Georgia State actually enjoyed this type of exemption, just as being a public university that had sovereign immunity, but other schools do not. I think I'm going to stop here because I want to get some feedback from you, especially on how to translate these best practices into the legal context, and I will just leave this slide with some of the legal challenges that I see in developing a conceptual framework that would enable us to argue that this type of codes have a particular legal status and that it could be relied upon in court and should get some legal significance in litigation. Okay.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Who wants to go first?
Hi, thanks very much. My name is Mark Tomizawa. I've been in the industry, so I've had copyright work in my favor. I've also had to worry about copyright when I needed pieces for work that was shown nationally or internationally. I also have friends in Hollywood and New York City who work for institutions that hold copyrights that want a cleaner resolution because it's really a lot of bad red tape for everybody involved. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's come up is the idea of approaching the transformative standard, right? So if it's transformational, that breaks new ground according to in the United States. We could use Creative Commons, put creative works there, give people, all kinds of users, including students, kids, everybody, permission to try remixing that to create a transformative work. That would then be presented as evidence that it is possible to use this work in a transformative way, and then we'd be able to shed some of the requirements that are currently in the copyright law. In other words, we have too much structure in the copyright law. Mm-hmm. We have too much scaffolding,
right,
and people are paralyzed. So it's a question of what do you take out?
Mm-hmm.
So the way to take it out is to have massive experimentation that people care about and say, you're given permission by Sony to remix this piece. Now, where has this happened? It's happening in universities around the world when it comes to educational software. There's a sandbox effect, and they've created a safe harbor. So perhaps what we do is we borrow from that, and we say, we've got a project for the world. And I was wondering whether you'd like that. The main problem is it's hard to innovate from within the institutions because the in-house counsel is going to say, no, that's risky.
Yeah.
So we actually need to have other people who are maybe freer thinkers do some freestyle work with the media.
Yeah, so a couple of reactions. First of all, thank you very much. These are great ideas. I think to address the fears of institution administrators, the best way to do that, in my opinion, being an administrator until last week, is to create coalitions. And I think that if all the universities, it's like kids, right? If all the universities are doing this, then I think the legal department would feel more comfortable taking the risk together, right? And not that it's less risky, because each of the institutions would have to bear the risk. But I think that it's also less likely, you know, like in litigation, when you actually address a large number of institutions, that, you know, I think that it's easier to persuade administrators in this context. With respect to transformative use, there is a difference. Educational use is not transformative in the regular sense. We use usually the materials as is. That's one of the problems. And therefore, it would normally not enjoy any fair use exemption, except that in the American fair use clause, it's actually explicitly stated that educational use would be exempted. But I think that with respect to... So what we think in educational context is that the actual use of a work for a purpose that is different than the original purpose would make it transformative. So educational setting would be considered transformative related to the function and not actually the transformation of the materials. I think the situation of publishers, especially of scholarly work, is different than the situation in the software industry and even in the media industry for various reasons. One is that publishing industry is an industry in crisis. They need to find a new business model. They need to justify their role. I mean, it is going through the crisis that the music industry has been through the past, you know, right, over the past decade. They rely on academic users. I think what we have seen with Elsevier last year is actually only the beginning of, hopefully, of a larger rebuild. I mean, who is working for Oxford University Press? Who is working for Cambridge University? Who is doing the reviews? Who is writing the papers? Who is doing the editing of books? It's just academics that find it difficult then to assign the materials for educational purposes in their own classes. So I think it would be, I would hope that we would have this type of innovation in the publishing industry that we start to work with in academic institutions in the same innovative way that you have described for the software and media industries. But I'm more skeptical that that would happen in this industry as well.
Thank you, Professor. When I think about and try to quantify the risk associated with vagueness in the fair use law, particularly in Israel but also in the United States, my mind thinks about the possibility of creating an insurance regime to insulate the authors or the users of these works from liability, and the possibility that the code of best practices that you've developed could serve as a rubric against which an insurance provider could evaluate risk. And I'm curious what your response would be to that kind of a formulation.
I think it's an excellent idea. It was used in the context of, I think, one of the first fair use best practices code was drafted for the documentary film industry. And in that context, they were able to, since it's a community of people who are both producers and users, so both sat to the table in drafting these, and they were using also insurance and brought into the table also the insurance companies. Insurance is tricky, right? Because you need to you know, if you ever read all these, you know, insurance policies, they would first ask you to declare that this is not a copyright infringement, right? I mean, you have to make sure that this is legal before you can get the insurance. But I think if the insurance companies are brought in, I think that could be a good outcome. I think since there is some public interest here, because we talk about our educational system, some of it is actually public, it would make more sense for states to simply say, we're the insurance, right? We would provide the insurance, and we exempt you from liability. If it is found at the end that this is not fair use, you'll be subject to an injunction, right? But you would not have to pay damages. That would make a huge difference. That would make a huge difference because it would enable educational institutions to feel more comfortable in exploring all these types of new uses of works. But yes, insurance definitely part of the game. The one who controls the mic is...
thank you for the talk. So you're describing this kind of community-based solution here, or community advocacy, and talking about collective action between universities. I'm a little bit curious about, in your experience with the Israeli example or in other things that you studied, kind of a collective action within the university, in particular like maybe a split between the administration and the faculty, especially when you see kind of the whole higher education business model starting to really change in that same way. You mentioned the recording industry. We talked, you know, some other examples. But as that is changing at the same time you're having this conversation, I can see maybe the administration being more skeptical about, kind of being more bold on this side if it'll embolden their, you know, their faculty to split off and, I don't know.
Interesting. What do you expect the administration position to be? Conservative?
Yeah, certainly more conservative,
right.
Yeah.
I agree. So therefore, the right approach is actually to invite the administrators as participants. They run the schools. You know, the academics are clueless. You know, I'm honest. I mean, this is like, they don't know what if you're a physics professor, you don't care about free. You just want to get you want to get the reading materials. You want the class to run. You're not going to do any clearance. You're not going to negotiate any best practices. It is the interest of the provost of the university, of the president of the university, of the librarians, of the deans of the schools. And actually, I think that there is some, that at this point of time, there is a lot of, what I found is that there are many mutual interests now between the administrators and the and faculty. And actually, as part of our own project, since we already established a coalition, we're now using it in order to promote open access to academic publications, which is definitely the interest of any of the scholars for various reasons. And so I think that there is some understanding also within this community, you know, of why it is important beyond the teaching requirement, also for your own academic and research work, to try and move forward with this type of agenda.
Hello, thank you for the talk. This will be more like a comment than a question. I'm doing some work on textbook piracy, and what I see is that a significant amount of the response to this legal uncertainty was that many of the practices in this legal gray zone just went underground, partly because professors' loyalties are not aligned with those of with publishers. They are aligned with students and doing the work done. And what I can say from the data is that 10% of the users of an illegal text archive are from the U.S., meaning that if I can't do it legally, I just point everyone else to some shady shadow library where they can do whatever they want. So when it comes to fair use best practices, there is actually a complete underground which has built its own norms and libraries around what they consider as proper behavior in the academic sphere using texts. My question would be, you know, how you solve this problem in the short run? Because if you try to treat this as a legal challenge, which might be right, then it, you know, it takes years and years and years and years till you probably reach some kind of a solution. On the other hand, everyone in this room has to solve a problem this semester and next semester and next week's class and so on and so on and so on. And this two rhythms being out of tune create lots of problems. So what's the prompt response beyond, you know, pointing my students to a shady Russian site?
Right. Well, thank you. These are very good comments, and I'll be interested in seeing the data, actually. But this creating this dark net, I think it's definitely true in the academic setting. So a lot of it is happening behind the blackboard high-learned walls, right, where publishers cannot access. And no one knows, actually, what is happening there. But once they bring a lawsuit, then you have to reveal, right? And then, of course, there is legal exposure to liability, I mean, in both cases. And also, I think that it's more problematic, especially as a strategy, for educational institutions, right? I mean, you cannot have as a strategy, your strategy as an academic institution that's supposed to educate students at all levels cannot be let's disobey the law or let's just, you know, I mean, you may choose to do it as a type of challenge, right? When you say there is some ambiguity, we decide to take the risk, but you cannot, as a strategist, just say, okay, just don't, I'm not going to care about that, and I'm just going to engage in whatever practices we need to engage because we really need the materials. And pretend that no one knows. So, but I agree with you, and that is partly has to do with the second point that you were making, that in some cases it's inevitable because, you know, the alternative is just to leave the students on their own, and in some places you see that happens. And students are copying, you know, they put a PDF of the entire book, not 10% and not 12%, right? This is the entire book is there, and it's not even reported in class. They, you know, they send the URL on Facebook, and that's it. And it's bad because the instructors are not involved, and that is something that we are actually giving up on, and I think that's important, that would become still. I think the teachers and professors should be an integral part of the learning environment.
So, Niva, I have a question, too. And it's more on the legal theory and its relationship to practice, which I think is utterly fascinating. But as I was listening to you, there's an irony in your critique of Creative Commons being essentially the mirror image of your support for best practices. So the 10-second version is one of your critiques of Creative Commons was that by crystallizing the permissions, you also crystallize the absence of permission for a vast set of things that people do in the dark, and that may end up restricting rather than enabling action. There's a possible mirror concern here where, given the extremely... What is this thing, after all? Imagine that all drivers got together and wrote a common code of practice that says, you know what, we really go roughly 10 miles above the speed limit. How would courts treat that as, oh, well, I guess if you get caught at 5 miles above, you're okay? Clearly not. On the other hand, we have all these things like custom and self-private ordering. They're usually defaults as opposed to forcing. So what do you think the legal meaning is? What is your translation? And in particular, how does this crystallization in the face of uncertainty talk to your older sense that crystallization in the face of uncertainty was restricting?
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a very important insight. I will even take it further. I was talking before about the awareness, the actual awareness. Making users aware of the rights is something that further make this educational environment more, simply by making people more aware of copyright, we create more disputes. Because this is an academic setting, is a setting that is rich. You know, it has a lot of writers and it has a lot of users, and all of us are both users and writers and authors. And once we assert our users' rights, we also assert our authors' rights vis-a-vis our colleagues and other institutions, and that just creates a lot of noise. And so. So I think that is some of the concern that I had, you know, regarding this initiative to begin with. But I think that with respect to restrictive, you know, that by crystallizing clear-cut rules, you're restricting the use, I think it's really important to maintain forums for deliberation. It has to be integral part of any ruling, of any coding, of any framework. I mean, it has to be part of the design. You can do it in licenses. You can do it in institutional structure. You can do it in laws. Actually, the Israeli law is a good example, even though it is not being used. But under Israel actually copied, reproduced, the American fair use section. That's why I think also it's an interesting case study for America, because, you know, not many countries have fair use. Very few, right? And so, but we copied that exactly the same rule, except that in the Israeli copyright law, under fair use, there is some discretion, administrative discretion for the Minister of Justice to actually create clear-cut rules under the fair use. And so...
Which then become safe harbors.
Yeah. So it's really difficult to reach that point. I mean, it hasn't been used yet. And if it would be used, it would probably have to involve all the stakeholders. The best practices approach is a little bit different, except in the case of the documentary film industry. In all other cases that I know of drafting fair use best practices, it was a unilateral action. It was a community saying, this is our interpretation, this is what we think. And I think now to the other part of your question, the way to incorporate it into the law is to move forward along the way that was drawn by the Canadian Supreme Court, to say, you have a standing as users under this law. We need to be attentive to your needs because you're not simply consuming someone else's work. You are participating in promoting culture. And therefore, it is not only sufficient to protect the rights of authors, but also users are part of this. So if we want to see what's the interests of authors, we look at the licenses of publishers. But what are the interests or the needs of users? Fair use best practices is where you look. So, you know, I think that it... you know, if this type of legal framework is, you know, gets become more common, I think it would make things easier.
One last question.
Thank you, Professor. I actually had the privilege of working on a best practices creation thing for higher education here, but at the Berkman Center for English teachers in mm-hmm. American colleges, never quite got enough momentum. Mm-hmm. You've mentioned users, you've mentioned stakeholders, and I completely agree about getting the use community to define what its practices are, but you also mentioned the danger of having a ceiling or a floor.
Right.
And when you spoke about universities, you mentioned about the administrators needing to be part of the conversation. And given what happened in the United States in the 70s when they tried to bring everyone to the table, and then they had the domination issues that you also have referenced so eloquently, I'm wondering what your thoughts are about effectively defining who to invite. Because if it's too broad, the existing power imbalances will simply be reified. If it's too narrow, it's not going to be particularly useful. So who gets to participate in defining the community that will then define the best practices?
Right. So excellent question. Thank you. This is when you draft fair use best practices, this is one of the questions that when you decide to go about this project, this is one of the questions that a community has to decide on, who is in and who is out. Whether you bring to the table also the producers, the publishers, who should be part of the conversation? Students, like in educational setting, professors, academics, administrators only, because, they have a continuous interest. I think from the perspective of best practices, the community has to decide. This is a choice of the community. I think to make it more powerful, it has to be to be as much as representative as possible. You have to you want to enroll as many parties as possible. I think that there is a value of keeping a distinct interest that you are working on, because as you've mentioned, and that was a bad experience that was that we had in the United States when you brought publishers into the table, the consensus that was reached was not useful. And it hasn't been used, after that draft was reached, right? But that's, in essence, I think the community has to make these choices, looking at the risks and opportunities in involving more or less parties.
So and it looks like there are more questions, but we have to shut down. Perhaps if you can stay
sure.
A little bit longer, people can come and ask you.
Yeah.
But thank you very much.
Thank you.